This is Car Expert.
It's as Aussie as you can get when you're not being as Aussie as you can get, but there are no V8 Utes around these days, so I think it's a bit of a winner.
The Hyundai Ioniq 5 lived up to all that hype, has it?
Yes and no.
GWM has got the Ute now, which is a far more attractive rival to the Hilux and the Steed, which was sort of like an Aldi home brand Ute.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy.
And hello, Jack Quick.
Hello, Mandy.
I am loving the story that's just gone on the site over the weekend, Jack, one that you've written, the cheapest cars you can buy in Australia, because I love cheap and cheerful cars. Which is the cheapest one we can buy here?
Well, currently, spoilers, read the story first, but currently, I don't want to speak too soon, but maybe next month it'll be something different, but currently it's the Mitsubishi Mirage, which is still potentially being
still
axed. Yeah, still. So it's going to potentially be axed towards the end of the month due to new side impact regulations that are going to be enforced for every car sold in Australia. So it might be saying goodbye, still not 100% certain, but the second, if it does go, the second cheapest car will be the Picanto. So similar little microcars in a dying segment, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I was doing a quite significant deep dive. It was lots of fun writing this article. I was getting all my nerdy specs and that. So talking about how there's only three cars left in the segment, the Mirage, the Picanto, and the Fiat 500 for the microcars in the VFACT segment. So it's a far cry from when the segment was introduced in 2014, when the boom happened and they had to differentiate it from the light car segment. And I know that you'll like this, Mandy, but like the Volkswagen Up and all of those cars similar to are all part of that segment. And it was a different time before. I feel I'm going to say my age here, but I was only in year 10 at the time. Before the SUV crossover craze kind of happened, and it's insane to think now that the cheapest cars, what was cheap like 5 to 10 years ago, for example, the Yaris is now almost 25 grand. Which then almost puts it in the next segment, the luxury light car segment, which then puts it up against like the Audi A1, the Mini three-door hatch and the Citroen C3, which is like just a Toyota. So yeah, the Yaris hasn't featured, but it was fun seeing all the different SUVs. So for example, the Suzuki Ignis and also the Hyundai Venue make a feature towards the end of my list. So many different cars that are a lot more expensive than I thought too. Yeah.
Jack, of all the cars on your list, and I don't want you to give all of them away because it's a story that we actually need to read, which would you most like to own?
That's a great question. I would go for, I would say, maybe like a Volkswagen Polo. It's towards the upper end, but it's like that little bit. Even though I have a manual right now, I would love to get an auto, and I know that getting the Polo kind of pushes it outside of my list. But I think base model Polo would be that fun little get around car for just what I need to do in the city. And going back to my list, a lot of these cars are just city micro and light cars. You're not really going to get much else. So I'd say the Polo. Yeah.
Nice. Were there any performance cars in there? Like, for example, like the Polo GTI? I'm assuming that wasn't the GTI on your list.
I,
but-
I did make a for a lot of the entrance, I made like a little bit of like a history and all that kind of stuff. And it was quite fun going through, say, like the Ignis and I'm going to be spoiling all of it now, the Swift as well, the Suzuki Swift, and going into depth about like how the Swift has been in Australia for a very long time, and there's been like the GTI models in the past, and there's currently like sport models, but no real sporty models are cheap in Australia at the moment. And unless you want to call the Mirage with some like fancy black wheels sporty, or like more of this like appearance packages, but but yeah, unfortunately, you're stuck most with naturally aspirated 3 and 4 cylinder engines. So if you think that's sporty, great. But yeah.
So I think the answer to that then is no.
Yeah. Not
sporty. just a long way of saying, sorry, Mandy, no.
I don't really care. My car is a 1 liter 3 cylinder and I am happy as beans driving that thing. So you don't need performance to have fun in little cars.
Yeah, literally says me. With my Jimny, I have a 1.5 litre naturally aspirated 4-cylinder that just makes like 70-something or other kilowatts of power, and I can barely get to 100 within like a certain period of time. So, yeah, who am I to talk?
I think my app is like 59 kilowatts going from memory, which is tiny.
I can't believe that I'm sitting with two people who make my 2005 Pajero look like a Ferrari 458.
How are you talking about going, by the way? We suppose you can't drive much of it at the moment.
I can't do much driving at the moment. It's actually going up on car sales soon.
No!
Yeah, so I am at the moment hopefully trying to buy a house is what I'm working on anyway. So if you do see a Pajero with the registration TSP, it's in great condition and they are China's finest shocks on the rear axle. They weren't just the cheapest ones I could get to make it roadworthy. Don't believe what you think.
Have you been doing a bit of research in pricing it? Yes, or
I have a little bit. I am, yeah. It is amazing what people are paying for cars at the moment. And even, I mean, this is a 16-year-old car now, but because it's a diesel, it's in good condition and the engine's fantastic in it. Not that I'm trying to sell it or anything.
Buy it now.
So it is worth a little bit compared to what I really thought it would be. And I think as we get into summer and people want to go towing and off-roading and overlanding and adventuring, it's only going to be better again. So I guess what I'm saying is the Pajero is the perfect car for you.
Sales pitch wrapped up.
News time. Over to you first, Jack. And it looks like we've got more Toyota Land Cruisers coming to Australia, thankfully.
Yeah, well, we hope. There's nothing confirmed yet, but we hope. So Toyota has said that in November it's targeting a record number with the promise of more Land Cruisers coming. We'll see whether that actually happens because, as we know, there's been a lot of delays and all those kind of things with Land Cruisers. So we'll have to see, but the promise is there. So the details. So there's going to be more right-hand drive 300 series Land Cruisers that are bound for Australia. And the plants that will be producing them will recommence in November. Reason why they're shut in the first place is the due to the global semiconductor shortage and also COVID-19 shutdowns, which has caused shortages and long wait lists worldwide. Toyota isn't alone with this. It's been having a lot of issues with a lot of its core models. So it's not only just an issue for Land Cruisers and other Toyota models, but Volkswagen, you name it. Different manufacturers have all had the same kind of thing, but they're hoping that this, once they restart this, their production, and they'll have a better supply of Land Cruisers starting to hit showrooms during 2022. But as I said before, I'll have to wait and see how this actually works out because I'm not really certain how it's going to work because As I said, I don't want to jinx myself because I want to see 300 series Land Cruisers, but I'm not certain whether it's going to happen soon. Reason for this, I say, is because they've had their first Toyota's had their first allocation of Land Cruisers come into Australia, and as you probably saw from like Paul's video, I had to get it from a dealership. So numbers are strictly limited, with the few that are available, limited for like demos and things like that. And Toyota has said that the retail launch is still unconfirmed. So that means that there's like they can't be offering to customers 300 series yet. So it's going to be a long time. So with November, Toyota's aiming to build around over all of their models between 850,000 and 900,000 in November, as I said, which is an increase on the 830,000 that were produced last year. And overall, Toyota has a goal that's unchanged. So with all of these shortages and shutdowns, they're still hoping. It's pretty ambitious, I think, given all of the delays, that the company's wanting to produce 9 million cars by the end of its fiscal year, which is the end of March 2022. I'm hopeful, but as I said, I don't want to jinx it. I don't think anything's going to be coming super soon, and there's a backlog of orders. Going to be waiting a fair while, I'm pretty certain.
It's going to be really interesting to see what this actually does mean for Australia, because Toyota recently took what is a pretty unprecedented step and actually came out and said, we're really sorry for these delays. There's nothing we can do about them, and we understand it's frustrating for customers. Production is really hard, and that's what Tesla has shown in trying to get its brand ramped up. And Toyota has been better than most at actually managing how it produces cars and its supply chain through all of this COVID stuff and just in general. I mean, it actually came out earlier in the pandemic and said that it had ordered enough semiconductors in advance. It was very, very, well sorted with its supply chain, and that other brands should take a leaf out of its book. So it's going to be interesting to see if Toyota, having had to pull the lever to slow down, can just press a button and speed up again. And if it does, what it actually means for Australia, because more Land Cruisers would be great, but it seems like we're now at a point where demand is so high, it's going to take more than just one big month to catch up, not just in Australia, but around the world.
Yeah, I have a bit of a story. Even from my partner, he's heard a story, so it's kind of far-fetched. But it's a story nonetheless. So this person has sold their 200 series Land Cruiser in the hopes of getting a 300 series, and I think it's pretty ambitious, whatever. They've gone to Toyota dealership wanting to, I want to get a 300 series. Awesome, sick. Here's my deposit, this, that, and the other. Dealership's been like, no, that's not happening. So in the meantime, they've been carless, and they've had to get a 120 series Land Cruiser Prado to kind of bridge the gap, because it's just not possible to get a 300 series within the next 12 to 18 months. And I think you said it perfectly, Scott. A good month isn't going to fix anything. It's going to be a long time before we see Land Cruisers more consistently on the road, rather than just like, oh, here's one, let me take a picture of it, because it's so rare. I think it's going to be a while.
Now, Scully, the 2022 Honda Civic SI has been unveiled in the US, but we're just assuming that we're not going to get this one either.
Yeah, add this to the list of exciting and interesting cars that don't make it to Australia. The Honda Civic, the current model, which is being run out at the moment, is quite an interesting car because it's massive, it's comfortable. It's actually got quite a nice 1.5-litre turbocharged engine. But it's not the most exciting thing in the world unless you go for the Type R with its awesome engine and its manual gearbox. In the USA, Honda has always had something to slot in between the normal range and the Type R range. And it's always been called the SI, and there's a new one. It's got 149 kilowatts of power just below redline, and it's got 260 newton meters of torque. So it doesn't make incredible numbers when you consider what you get from a Kia Cerato GT or a Hyundai i30 N line. But what it does have is a 6-speed manual gearbox, a really interesting looking interior, and an exterior that, unlike some old Honda performance stuff, is really understated and quite classy. It's one of those cars that probably wouldn't sell in huge numbers because it is a manual and because it's a bit of an enthusiast thing, but we would love to see in Australia. But unfortunately, the SI is off the table for us at the moment. That's what we understand anyway. Unless Honda wants to start building right-hand drive cars in the USA for us, it's likely to stay that way as well, which is a shame, but at least we know we've got the Type R coming next year at some point, hopefully.
Very true. Have we ever had the SI here?
We have once. Okay. In the USA, it's got quite a cult following. It's known as this sort of lightweight, simple driver's car. The one we got in Australia was in 2011, and it was right around the end of the eighth generation five-door hatch, which was the really futuristic one. It had the plexiglass across the front of it, and the badge was hidden inside that and had the rocket ship door handles. My grandma actually owned one. This is Tesla grandma. And for all intents and purposes, it was otherwise a pretty normal hatchback that was really noisy on the highway, is my memory of that car. But, yeah, well, we got a version of the SI in that generation. But since then, the Civic we've got in Australia has been built elsewhere to the US model. I think our current generation or the now replaced generation Type R comes from the UK, but the rest of our Honda Civic range comes from Thailand and they don't do the SI there.
Jeez. I wish we would get that here because I actually don't mind the understated look of the new Civic now. So less plastic, less angles and all sorts of things happening. So
that interior looks awesome too. It's quite like retro futuristic almost. So, yeah. I mean, we often say this with enthusiast cars. It looks great. We'd love to see it. I can understand why it doesn't come here because we're a small market and they'd sell eight of them probably. But still a little bit disappointing.
Yeah, just a tad. Hey, Jack, the 2022 Mercedes-AMG SL reveal has been delayed. Do we know why?
Yes. So reason uncertain at this stage. It's only been delayed for 8 days, thankfully. So it's not like the Land Cruiser, so delayed for months and months and months, even though we know it's coming. And similar to the Civic, I don't think it would be a model that would sell a lot in Australia, if it comes to Australia. But at the moment, the debut's been pushed back until October 28. So we should see it by the end of the month. I've been running a fair few articles about it, and I know, Scott, you would have too, in the last year or so. And since kind of researching and it's kind of got me like hyped up for the reveal because it's my like first sort of one of the first cars that is going to be revealed while I'm like a full-time journalist, which is quite exciting. And it's going to be replacing the GTC Roadster, which has been on sale since like 2014-ish. I can't remember exactly. That might be the coupe, but yeah, it's being discontinued with this indirect replacement as the SL Roadster. And it's going to be this new platform is going to be forming the underpinnings of the upcoming AMG GT Coupe, which is not confirmed yet, but quite exciting for when it will happen because I wrote a story last week or so, AMG GT and a Coupe and Roadster, the two-door models, no more in Australia and it's dealer stock only. So have to say goodbye for now. And hopefully this SL Roadster will kind of pick up the slack for the meantime until the GT Coupe is announced. Going back to underpinnings, it's going to be an aluminium chassis and it's going to be called the Modular Sports Architecture. So it sounds kind of fancy, like lightweight. And with this SL Roadster, it's going to be one of the first models in a long time to be bringing back the 2+2 seating configuration. So you can get your buddies and you can go on a road trip with the convertible rooftop down. But I'll stop there because the rear seats, you can only have passengers up to 1.5 meters tall. So I don't think I'd be able to put Scott in the back seat and
sign me up to test that one.
It's more or less just for like kids or like a couple of bags of groceries, a gym bag. Maybe you could get a golf bag along the back seat. I'm not quite certain, but Yeah, regardless, not that much space in the rear. And it's going to be the first model to have a soft top roof rather than a hard top roof for the first time in 20 years, which is a fair while in SL history, which has a very, very long history. I want to say 66 years since the 300 SL was released. It's a very long time. One thing we've also seen too is the interior, which is very fancy, very flash, very, very Mercedes is how I would describe it. It's very similar to the new S-Class in the sense that it has very similar 11.9-inch tilting touchscreen. A portrait, looks quite nice and luxurious and plush. But going away from the interior at this stage, until we know more of the details and the reveal is actually live and whatnot, we don't know what's going to be powering the SL. So we think it's going to be like a 3-liter turbocharged straight six or a 4-liter twin turbo V8. But regardless, it's going to be having a 48-volt mild hybrid system. And going back to what I said at the start, seeing that I've covered it a fair bit, I reckon it looks pretty good. But what do you think, Scott? Do you reckon the new SL looks any good?
I actually was going to say, I think it'll be really interesting to see how this is received, because if we talk automotive legends, the Volkswagen Beetle, the Land Rover Defender, and the Mercedes SL are all kind of up there. And the most recent generation hasn't really got people excited like all of its predecessors, but this is one of the longest running names in motoring. And it also, some of its previous sort of models have included the beautiful Gullwing, those really, I think, gorgeous blocky 90s SLs from the from the first Need for Speed games. I still remember racing an SL350, I think, in Need for Speed Hot Pursuit. It's a really storied name from Mercedes, and it used to represent the pinnacle for the brand, but its role's kind of changed. So I think these spy photos do look good, to answer your question, Jack. I quite like that Merc has really upped the drama and the shape of it again, because the current one's a little bit sort of amorphous. It's a bit blobby, I think.
Is how I would describe
it. Yeah, exactly. But more than that, I'm excited that Mercedes is making a big deal of the SL and trying to reposition it as its flagship, putting it on equal billing with the AMG GT, because that's what that car always stood for. And I think a good Merc SL would be a really, really interesting car to spend some time with and, you know, just enjoy in summer, but also see how people react to it. There's something about a Merc convertible, I think.
One thing I didn't mention, sorry, is that this is going to be the first SL that's going to be wearing the Mercedes AMG nameplate. So it's all of the development has been undertaken by Mercedes AMG. So it's not going to be called a Mercedes-Benz SL blah, blah, blah anymore. It's going to be Mercedes AMG. And that's when you know that means they mean business. So it's going to be a cool little thing. Oh, I say little, it's probably huge, but it's going to be a rocket ship, I reckon. Whether it's going to be quick, seeing it's convertible, undecided, but it's going to be cool, I reckon.
And lastly, Scully, it looks like GWM Havel is kicking goals here in Australia.
It seems like every second week we're talking about a Chinese brand that sells in really incredible numbers in Australia. GWM or Great Wall Motors or Havel or some variation of that, because they've got a few different sub-brands, is one of the fastest growing, and that's because it's got the Canon Ute, which competes in a really competitive segment, and it's a really good thing at a really good price based on our drives of the car. This week, it has confirmed that it's sold 884,045 cars worldwide over the first three quarters of 2021, which is up just a lazy 30%. The majority of those were made in China, which has always been the case with GWM, and recently they've decided they want to look outward. That's not happening overnight. But of the 97,946 that were exported, the majority came to Australia. Just over 13,000 of them, to be precise. So that's a sales growth of 270% year on year compared to the same point last year, which is just massive. But it also shows how important our market is to GWM and to Havel. Australia is really, really competitive, but it's also a place where quite a few car brands have decided that they're going to be able to set up shop and to sort of test expanding as factory operations beyond their home markets. And some of the Chinese brands have used us that way. GWM has recently launched a ton of new products. It's started a big marketing push. And obviously, it's got the Ute now, which is a far more attractive rival to the Hilux and the Steed, which was just was sort of like an Aldi home brand Ute to look at. It's got some really good products and some really big money behind it and some really big goals from its head office in China that mean it's hard to see that growth slowing down. Already we know next year we're going to get the Havel H6 hybrid. It's actually built at an old General Motors plant in Thailand. So I'd be very surprised if this time next year we're not talking about even bigger numbers again and Australia playing an even bigger role.
I'm really looking forward to the H6 hybrid. It's a really good I know James was kind of talking about it. I'm not certain if it was on podcast, but he was saying it's going to be a really good RAV4 rival. So it's going to be super interesting once that comes to Australia. And I know, as you said at the start, Scott, there's all sorts of different GWM sub-brands. And I remember writing about like the Aura, electric vehicles. And
That H6 hybrid looks really interesting. It's also pretty powerful. It's got 179 kilowatts and 530 newton meters. What? And it's all front-wheel drive. So I just can't wait to start smoking the front wheels in traffic light drag races.
I think it's quite interesting that we actually get the torque figure compared to the RAV4, which doesn't quote the torque figure. I've always kind of wondered what torque that would the RAV4 would offer. Do you have any idea what that would be, Scott, at all, or you have no clue, just like me?
I don't know. Toyota is quite careful with this stuff because realistically, the electric motor and the petrol engine don't hit their peak at the same time.
Of course.
So if they're not crossing over or they're not crossing over for very long, I think Toyota's thing is that it doesn't really matter how much peak torque you have as long as the electric motor is doing its job down low and the petrol engine higher up in the rev range. Obviously, if you're Havel, you don't have 20 years of Toyota hybrid experience to sell on the back of, and that torque figure and the outputs are one way for them to differentiate it from the petrol models and also from the RAV4. So I can understand why Havel is quoting them, but yeah, Toyota, maybe it just has really average figures if you combine the electric motor and the petrol engine. I don't know. But, yeah, it doesn't quote them, and I don't have a good number for you, unfortunately.
That's right. You can just do some wheel spins, as you said, in the Havel H6 hybrid. I think that would be awesome.
All right. You can read more car news at carexpert.com.au. We've been talking about it a lot on the Car Expert podcast, but has the all-new EV model, the Hyundai Ioniq 5, lived up to all that hype? Paul Marrick can tell us because he's been driving it all this week. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Mandy and team. How are we?
Very good. I'm actually excited to talk to you about this because I'm really hoping it has lived up to the hype. Has it?
Yes and no. So, look, firstly, it is, for those who don't know, a full electric Hyundai. It sits on a brand new platform for them, which means it should, in theory, be very good compared to some of their older cars, which were, internal combustion platforms with electric components shoehorned in. And they weren't necessarily bad. They were still highly efficient and good to drive, but they weren't really the real deal. So this being the real deal, I had high hopes for it. And look, I can say that from a design point of view, it absolutely turns heads. The car looks so cool in person. And like I've said this to a lot of people in pictures, it looks tiny. But then when you see it in person, it's enormous.
And, or next to your Tesla.
Well, yes, I was going to say that's something that a lot of people say about me as well. But it is one of those cars that simply gobbles things up around it. And when you see it in person, it is quite large. So longer and wider than a RAV4, and the wheelbase is longer than a Palisade. So it is big in that respect. We had the top spec, so it was around $75,000 plus on-road costs. It's sold out in Australia for the rest of this year. And it may seem like a lot of money, but it comes loaded with every feature you could think of. So you have heated and cooled seats, head steering wheel. You've got the remote parking feature. You have vehicle to load, which allows you to use the charge port of the car to power anything else really, add up to 3.6 kilowatts through a 15-amp socket. So it does come with all the bells and whistles, and certainly inside it has a lot of room as well. What do you reckon about the design, Mandy? Does it tickle your fancy?
Yeah, I've loved it ever since I first saw it. I think it's even better than the EV6, because I know we've had this conversation before on the podcast, but every angle, like I really love the rear of it as well, just the overall shape. But you're right, like I'm like a lot of other people who took me by surprise as to how big it was. To me, it looked like a small hatchback size.
Yeah, I put some pictures up on my social media of it parked in front of a Hyundai Accent. And not only does it illustrate how far Hyundai has come since the Accent of the early 2000s, it is enormous compared to the Accent. The Accent looks like it could fit in the boot of it. The interior is beautifully presented, and it feels to me like it is worth $75,000. Like it actually feels like it is good value for money. But there are a couple of drawbacks, and the first one is around packaging. So obviously it's a unique EV platform, which means it should be able to be packaged very easily because you don't have a driveline down the center of the car. You don't have all these things getting in the way. Unfortunately, they just haven't really used the space wisely. So the boot, for example, it's 500 odd liters on paper, but ultimately when I go to put my pram in, for example, it used up more boot space than it did in my Tesla, which is a significantly smaller car. There's barely any subfloor space in the boot. So again, with my Tesla, it's half a meter deep that you can put things in, whereas with the Hyundai, there's a subwoofer there and barely any room for anything else. Same story at the front. There's like 27 liters of storage in the front compared to three or four times that amount in the Tesla. So from a packaging point of view, I just think they could have done a whole lot better than they actually did.
Compared to your Tesla, how does the dual motor performance of the IONIQ 5 feel? Because it's obviously much faster than we'd expect of a normal family SUV, but I don't know that it's quite Tesla quick.
Yeah, look, it's not. And I think initially I was a bit disappointed with the acceleration times. I think it's 5.2 seconds to 100 for the all-wheel drive. But in reality, it's actually pretty fast. And I think most EVs are about as quick as each other from 0 to 60. It's that 60 to 100 where you'll get most of them making up space. And that's certainly what the Tesla does. It feels quite strong all the way through to 100. So 0 to 60, it feels pretty much as quick as the Tesla. And it's a beautiful car to drive in that sense. Like it has plenty of throttle response. In and around the city, it's really sort of quite sort of soft and comfortable despite the fact it rides on 20-inch alloy wheels. But it really all just comes apart when the speeds pick up. And a good example is we've been doing a lot of testing recently at Holden's former proving ground at Lang Lang. And, I mean, the ride and handling track there is just a perfect example of a cross-section of Australian roads. They have tram tracks, they have undulations, they have corrugated sections. Like it's just a really good summation of what you'll find in Australia. And while Hyundai used to do ride and handling tuning of pretty much every car that was accepted into Australia, the IONIQ, the Staria, the Tucson all missed out on this stuff. And while the Tucson and the Staria were fine, we tested them at the same place, the IONIQ 5 just really just had a lack of body control and just wasn't very enjoyable to drive. And even at speeds of 130 k's an hour, which is the maximum legal speed you can do in Australia, on a section of undulations that will mimic a country road, the car was almost leaving the ground. Like it just has so much airtime, and it really is just uncomfortable to drive at any sort of great pace. And that concerns me because they're doing an N version of this. The Kia EV6, the fast version of that, is going to be as quick as a Tesla, and it shares the same platform. So it suggests to me that they've softened out the ride as much as they can to cater for the 20-inch alloy wheels. But in practice, it's affected the handling. And I completely agree that this is no sports car. It's not marketed as a sports car, but ultimately it's not confidence inspiring. And the only car that performed as badly as this over that same stretch of road was the Havel H6, which I would expect to be not as good based on the Chinese roads and the way that they tune their cars for their roads. So, yeah, I came away a little disappointed in terms of the way that it drove.
How did you go with the did you do like a 0 to 100 acceleration test at all?
Yeah, so it pretty much hit the claim. It was sort of within earshot of where it needed to be. The straight line stuff you can't argue with. It uses a set of Michelin Pilot Sport EV tyres, and they do a tremendous job of giving you plenty of traction plenty of grip, but also traction in the wet as well. So it sort of it rounded out everything really nicely. I love the fact that they've integrated a thing called the iPedal. So it's basically a version of Nissan Leaf's e-pedal, and it allows you to come to a complete stop just by rolling out of the throttle. Works better than the e-pedal in the Nissan Leaf, and it works as good as the Tesla setup as well, which I love about my car. But it even just silly things like you have to engage that mode every single time you start the car. You have to engage that mode every time you come out of reverse, and if you forget to do it, you assume the car is going to stop, but it doesn't, and it just keeps going, and it's like, why does this not just stay on? It's just so silly. Even stuff like under the bonnet, you've got the cover for the storage area has EV written on it, and it's like, well, duh, it's an EV, like, obviously. The start button has EV, wow. Start, stop. It's like, yeah, okay, just start, stop would do as well. So I don't know. It's just weird that it's kind of like a novelty EV instead of it just being a regular form of transport. They've tried to make it novel. It's like it's just a car. It doesn't need to be novel just because it's an EV.
Paul, as the first car built on Hyundai's new global platform, Hyundai was talking a lot about its charging speeds and its vehicle-to-load capability. Did you get to check out how it stacks up at a fast public charger? And also, did you plug in your coffee machine?
Yes. No, I saw a video of someone, they were cutting their hair or something silly like that. No, I didn't do that. I thought I'd have a look at the practicality of it all. I actually went to one of the chargers here in Melbourne that's capable of 350 kilowatts and 800 volts. And they have a patented inverter on board that will do it will do anything up to 800 volts. So it can vary itself in between. And that's patented to Hyundai. And it means that it can charge, in theory, in the future, up to 350 kilowatts. But at the moment, it's capped to around 230 kilowatts. But when I took it to this charger, I did have a state of charge from around 48%. So it really wasn't the full band to test it properly, but I only peaked at around 120 kilowatts. The same charger on a Tesla Model 3 when it first came out, we managed to achieve 193 kilowatts. And Tesla has since upgraded some of its superchargers to V3, which allow 230 or 240 kilowatts as well. So I was a little disappointed with the charging speed on a fast DC charger, but that could just be because the battery needed to be charged from a lower state of charge. But on the vehicle to load thing, I am looking forward to this being a thing on all EVs and especially utes. So in the future, when a tradie rocks up to a worksite in an EV ute, the worksite doesn't even need to have power. You can literally just have an extension cable running out of your EV ute and you can power all of the appliances on the worksite. So I think that's pretty cool.
One thing I'm a little bit curious about, kind of going off charging speeds and that, what was the range like in the Ioniq 5? How does it compare, say, to your Model 3? Is it more, less? Did it display something and then it dilapidated quicker? Or what was it like?
Well, that's the thing. With EVs and range, generally, I tend to ignore the range. Well, I've learned to ignore it in my car because it's generally not accurate in the sense that it depends on your previous driving history. And if you go from driving in the city to the highway, all of a sudden it will sort of affect it. And this is a good example with the Ioniq. It was basically, it started at around 420 kilometers range displaying. But when I charged it to full after our week with the car where I did about 600 Ks, it was showing 380 Ks of range. And that was based on the previous driving where we did a lot of highway driving. In terms of the efficiency, though, Hyundai claims 19 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometres. We ended up achieving 19.9 on test. How does that compare? Well, my long-term average on the Model 3 performance, this is the faster one, is 18 or thereabouts. Scott, when he tested the Model 3 long range, which is what this would compete with, I think you were hitting around 15 or so, Scott?
Yeah, from memory, it was mid-14s, and that involved a pretty long stretch at 100 k's an hour, 110 k's an hour over on the freeway to Ballarat. So that was warm weather, aircon blasting, highway speeds.
And that's the thing. The main difference there is to do with the weight. So Tesla Model 3 weighs around 1,700 kilos. The Ioniq 5 is 2,100 kilos. So you're shifting a lot of mass. And that's despite the fact they both have almost the same size battery. So it's the technology they've used isn't as good as the Tesla setup. It is a bigger car than the Tesla, granted. But when you look at the packaging, you don't actually really see the benefits of that extra size when you can't actually store things better than you can in the smaller Tesla.
How did you go in the second row, Paul? Was it sort of spacious for an adult to sit?
It is. There's actually a fair bit of room. It didn't have a huge amount of tow room, which was a little disappointing. I find that in a lot of EVs, but there was heaps of accommodation to stretch out, and you can even recline both the driver and front passenger seat to almost fully flat when you're charging, which is cool. So, yeah, from an accommodation point of view, it was really good. And with the panoramic glass roof as well, it makes the space feel bigger. This car had white seats as well, so it just felt like a big open space inside the cabin.
Fantastic. All right, you can check out videos, especially on Paul's social media page as well.
Bombarded everyone.
Oh, it's been great. The review is live at carexpert.com.au. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, guys.
It's really great to have on the Car Expert podcast for the first time our off-road editor, Simon Christie. Welcome, Simon.
G'day, and thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Before we get stuck into your off-road review of the 2022 Ram 1500 Express, can you give us an idea on your background in cars and off-roading?
You've only got 10 minutes, haven't you? So in a nutshell, at the moment, we produce two TV programs around off-roading for 7Mate, one for Foxtel, another one for YouTube, and we've got collectively around in excess of 3 million organic social media fans.
Wow. You don't need to say any more than that. We've definitely got the right guy on the right job for this review then. So we'll get stuck into it. I don't think I've ever seen one of these utes before. Where did you manage to find it?
So a mate of mine was getting it and getting it set up. We assisted him a little bit with that, and the opportunity came up to do a photo shoot on it. So I thought that would be a great review for Car Expert and something a little bit different. It's a brand new current model, but it's accessorized, it's done up a little bit, and what a better way to go out and test an off-road vehicle, but an accessorized one that's actually purpose-built for off-roading. So we got our hands on it, we went out and we had some fun.
Fantastic. What sort of mods has it got?
Bull bar, winch, suspension, larger tyres, different rims, a sports exhaust, which made a big difference. Mm. With the Ram, you've got a massive statement. It's a big truck. This one was the bright red colour, so it's an eye-opening vehicle. It catches a lot of attention, but this one with the sports exhaust, it really made the best out of that V8 Rumble. So it's the old Aussie bloke, the Bogan rattling down the highway with that big V8 rumble. It's as Aussie as you can get when you're not being as Aussie as you can get, but there are no V8 utes around these days, so I think it's a bit of a winner.
What sort of money is one of these worth?
Well, that's a terrible question to me because I always get handed the keys for things. I don't go and buy them. So my answer to that question is pretty simple. Too much. So They're a big vehicle. They're purpose-built for a reason. They're popular for good reason. And people are spending money on them because you can't find anything in the market that will do what this does. But for the amount of money you spend, which is on the plus size of 100K, you're not getting a lot of what we're typically used to with Japanese cars, with the luxury, with the fit-out, with the appointments. And especially in these days with the four-drive market, you're not getting the safety features. So you're paying for the bigger engine, you're paying for the bigger vehicle, you're paying for the towing capacity. And to a lot of people who need to tow the horse float, the big ski boat, or a giant caravan, they're retired, they've got that amount of money, they're happy to do it, but you're missing out on a couple of other things that we think are also just as important in the automotive sector. Hmm.
Simon, you mentioned that the Ram is big compared to even a Hilux or a Ranger or something like that. How does it actually go on tighter off-road trails? Does it feel like it's too big and you've got to tiptoe around?
I'm trying to find the right words to say I was very cautious. yeah, you've got to be careful with it. But with that said, what you've got to understand is people look at these vehicles and they do look big. They are certainly right in your face. With that said, and you've mentioned Hilux, Ranger, and the typical common sorts of four-wheel drives we see on the trails, but it's actually only, I think somebody quoted, it's about 3 centimetres wider than a Patrol. So it's actually not much bigger than a Patrol or a Land Cruiser. It is longer in the wheelbase, and that has pros and cons for off-roading. So it was really surprising for me how well it did fit down our trails and that it did actually have a place in Australian off-roading.
How did all the off-road controls go in it?
Well, the off-road controls all worked fine. It's the issues are probably a little bit before that. First of all, you've got a stonking V8 motor, which I can't emphasize enough, is just awesome to drive and a lot of fun. And there should be a lot more vehicles on the roads with V8s. But the reality is that sitting at our speed limit on 110 on the freeway, controlling that amount of horsepower, that amount of cubic inches, which is what we're all desperate for, was really difficult. It was on the accelerator, backing off, on the accelerator, backing off. It was really hard. Of course, you can just hit the buttons and go cruise control, but once you're out of cruise control, it's actually really hard to maintain speed. So that made the car a little bit difficult to drive on the freeway. Getting off-road, you just tend to drive the vehicle a little bit more aggressive with the sound and the response you get from it, and the vehicle handles and throws itself around quite well. When you get down into gearing it down for more serious off-roading, the vehicle gears down nicely. You've got plenty of cubic inches down low for good grunt, and the vehicle responds well with good amounts of torque at low RPM. So it actually handles itself quite well. The transmission controller, where you sit in the vehicle and you're looking next to you for a shifter, is actually a dial on the dashboard. And that was quite quite disconcerting, because you're used to flicking dials and pressing buttons on the dash whilst you're moving. So actually having to trigger your brain to say, I've got to stop the vehicle before I go from drive to reverse, just because that knob was taken from a manual shifter on the center console to up on the dashboard was really quite troubling. So it took a little bit more mental effort. Once you got past that, the four-wheel drive switch was just below that, and it all worked very well. So off-road, it was quite surprising. It was quite good.
Did you get a chance to test it towing, or if not, how do you think it would go?
The article I wrote for Car Expert started out by basically saying, I don't care about its towing ability. I don't care how many planks of timber you can throw into the back of it. We're taking it off-road and getting it dirty. And that's what it was about. When it comes to towing, though, this is the reason that people are buying these vehicles primarily, apart from making a statement, just because they are such good, solid tow vehicles. They're big, they're heavy, and they've got plenty of cubic inches to tow the biggest caravans around Australia. And that's what we're seeing. We're actually lacking a lot of. We're seeing a lot of people out on the roads in vehicles that are quoted at having a 3,500 kilo towing capacity. And in my game and under real world conditions, that's probably stretching the truth a little bit. Whereas you go to a Ram and you've got a big, heavy, solid vehicle that's got the power, it's got the weight, it's got everything you need to actually tow those big caravans. So towing, 100%, that's what it's designed for.
Simon, you mentioned the price on this earlier. Given this sort of budget, what could you do to call it a Ranger or a Hilux? And could you turn, you know, maybe something with a less sexy engine but a much cheaper starting price into even more of an off-road weapon with the same kind of cost up front?
No. And look, you're really talking chalk and cheese, because it's not that the Rangers, Hiluxes, D-Maxes aren't capable, and it's not that you can't throw money at them and turn them into excellent vehicles. It just comes down to size of the vehicle, weight of the vehicle, and cubic inches. And when we're coming off a chat just about towing, the Rangers, D-Maxes, and Navaras, they're not going to do what this can do in the space of towing. Off-roading, they're actually very similar. Solid rear axle, IFS up the front, which limits articulation, limits your off-roading, and you'd need to throw money at either a Ranger or the Ram to really make it work well off-road.
Well, there we go. There's some really great photos to accompany Simon's off-road review, so go check it out at carexpert.com.au. Well, thank you for your time, Simon Christie. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Great to be here and great to see some people.
The Kia Sorento plug-in hybrid is here, but you're tossing up if it'll be a better option over the diesel. Mike Costello is here to the rescue. Hello, Moco.
I don't know if I'm here to the rescue, but I appreciate the introduction nevertheless, Mandy. Good to see you guys.
You might know the answer, maybe. This is a great comparison. So what would you say to someone who is tossing up between these two cars?
Yeah, so really the thinking behind this piece was I wanted it to go beyond simply talking about Kia in specifics. Most market research that you read shows that Australians aren't really across exactly what a plug-in hybrid is. Everybody seems to get what a Tesla-style EV is. Toyota hybrids are so popular and you know, every Uber is one that people seem to get it. But plug-in hybrids remain a bit of a confusing thing to a lot of people. The sort of vehicles that offer daily EV range with the backup and reassurance of a petrol generator for those longer road trips. And I thought the Kia was a great way to kind of show, if you are thinking of making the switch, how does it compare to the diesel equivalent? And I think the statistic that really stands out for me is probably price. Now, before we delve into the capabilities that the plug-in hybrid Sorento has, it is worth pointing out that a GT line, which is the top of the range Sorento diesel, is a tick over 67 grand on the road, whereas the FEV is 82 grand on the road. So you're already talking about a $15,000 difference, where the only thing that changes is the drivetrain and everything else is the same. So it's a great way to strip away everything else and just focus on the technology at hand.
Wow. Do you think that is a too much of a price difference, or is it bang on?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, obviously it is, right? And yeah. I know I sound confusing, right? You're wondering, what the hell am I talking about? Yes, it is way too expensive. A Camry hybrid costs $2,500 more than a non-hybrid. Now, yes, a hybrid is a much simpler piece of kit than a plug-in hybrid, which has a much higher capacity battery that costs a lot more money. But nevertheless, that's a price differential that is so great, and I know Marich did some back-of-the-envelope calculations, you will never pay this car back. So you cannot make a financial decision around this car. You don't buy the FEV because you want to save coin, which means there has to be other reasons to buy the FEV instead. And I would point out that they could be the fact that compared to, say, a Volkswagen XC90 plug-in hybrid, which has less driving range on electric power than the Kia, costs $117,000. So when you put the Kia into its proper context, it becomes relatively well-priced, but put up against the diesel, kind of not. So it all depends how you look at it.
Price aside, why would you buy the diesel?
So this is where we really hone in. So the diesel, first of all, it's a great diesel. 2.2 litre turbocharged four-cylinder engine that really punches above its weight. It's got very good fuel economy. So you're talking just over 6 litres on the combined cycle, but more like 5.5 on a highway stint, which is where diesels are at their absolute happy place because they're just ticking along just above idle point in eighth gear. Obviously, driving range is great because of that. It's also got a bigger towing capacity. It's a little bit better in terms of rolling response, meaning if you're going 60 and you want to start going 80, it's going to give you that instant punch because it's got more torque at lower RPM and weighs less because of all the batteries in the FEV. And, of course, there's price as well. And when you think about what a lot of people are going to do with a Sorento 7-seat SUV, it's really about family adventures and road trips. It's about getting away, sticking the caravan or the boat on the back, putting the kids in and all of the luggage and heading off somewhere far away, especially in this post-COVID context that we live in. And my finding was very much that if you're buying a family SUV for adventure, really the diesels are still the one to go for. But the plug-in hybrid does have its merits, and that is particularly if you're somebody who's using the Sorento as, and I don't want to be pejorative about this, but a soccer mum car. If you're going to school, if you're going to the shops, if you're taking the kids to footy on the weekends, all of those urban errands are where the plug-in hybrid Sorento really, really shines.
With the Sorento plug-in hybrid, what we've found previously with some of these FEVs is that they have a really limited electric range that means that even if you charge every day, you're going to be leaning on the petrol engine. Mm. How far can you go on the battery in the Sorento, and could you realistically use this as an electric car in the city and only lean on the petrol engine when you go long distance driving?
You can, and that's, you've hit the nail on the head there, Scully, which is a plug-in hybrid is only as useful as its EV range is, because that's its differentiator. In the case of the Kia, it can do a claimed 68 kilometres on a single charge. However, that's using the NEDC test rationale. The WLTP, which is what they use in Europe, says 57 k's. James Wong and I averaged between 50 and 55 kilometres on a charge, and that's a few hour long charge done via your simple old PowerPoint at home. I had it parked in my driveway. I poked the cable through a window and into a PowerPoint running along the skirting board. We ain't talking high tech here. But so in other words, yes, given most data will show that the average Australian does 20 or 30Ks a day heading to work or school or whatever it is. Absolutely. And then on the weekends, when you're packing everything up and going away, unlike an EV where you're terrified you might run out of charge on the side of the road, you've got that petrol generator that can keep you on going. And the other thing about this car is, even when the battery's usable energy content is at zero, the regenerative braking system and the petrol engine keep just enough charge in the battery for it to drive like a regular hybrid. So you're still going to get fuel efficiency savings. So my combined cycle fuel economy with a flat battery was still at 7 litres, more or less what I got with the diesel. However, on longer highway trips, that differential changes up a little bit. So I'm pretty confident saying even with a flat battery, most of the time the FEV will be just as economical as the diesel. But then you've got to come back to the notion of if you're not charging your plug-in hybrid every night, if you're not utilizing those pure EV kilometers, what are you doing? Don't bother.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what beyond obviously the powertrain, what and the powertrain and the weight, more or less, what are the actual differences between the car, say in like spec level? What's different?
Precious little, actually, mate. So pretty much the one that we had in GT Line guys misses the remote smart park assist feature that's in the FEV that it misses. The diesel gets it, meaning with the diesel one, you can use the key fob as essentially a remote controller to pull the car out of tight car bays. That's not in the plug-in hybrid model. The plug-in hybrid does have some different menus, so it's got different instrument display with battery charge readouts and things like that. It's obviously got a lot of EV-specific menus in the central touchscreen. But the fundamental thing that Kia's done here, oh, and it also has, I should say, 19-inch wheels, not 20s, which is good because the plug-in hybrid is about 150 kilos heavier than the diesel because of all those batteries, so you want less sidewall to counteract it and smooth out the ride a little bit. But these vehicles are fundamentally the same, and any changes aside from the drivetrain, really, really limited.
Moco, one of the things that has set Hyundai and Kia hybrid products apart previously is the fact that they run through a gearbox even in electric mode. Can you notice the fact that this is geared and that the electric motor isn't mounted directly to the wheels in the Sorento, or does it feel sort of smooth and silent like a normal EV?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point with the mounting of the motor alongside the transmission there, which means that the two power sources can work simultaneously in a kind of parallel hybrid type setup. And that works really well. In EV mode, though, it's like any other sort of electric car in the way it behaves, very quiet, very punchy immediately off the mark before sort of tapering. And in hybrid mode, I was quite impressed with the overall sense of refinement. It doesn't flare. It doesn't make a lot of sort of weird loud noises like some eCVTs can tend to. It's actually quite a sophisticated, refined bit of kit. The way I think about this car is, it really is sort of a hybrid plus. So it drives like a hybrid at worst and it drives like an EV at best. Where it misses out compared to, say, the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross or Outlander plug-in hybrids, which are probably the best known of the plug-in hybrid SUVs, is they have got electric motors on each axle, which means that they can have electric all-wheel drive that's incredibly responsive to any slip that's detected on board. They also have a mode that you can press a button called save that forces the vehicle to run purely on petrol and to keep that battery at the level that it currently is when you hit the button, which means if you're doing a highway trip, you can leverage the petrol power at its most efficient and then switch over when you're back in town. Now, the Kia doesn't do either of those things, so it is missing some interesting novel features that even Mitsubishi puts in its FEVs, so you've kind of got to keep that into account. But by and large, pretty smooth, pretty refined, pretty comfy with that usable EV range. It sort of does what a good FEV should. And I guess it fundamentally comes back to the idea of, are we ready for FEVs in this country yet? On a cost basis, probably not. But on a daily usability basis, I can see the merit, absolutely.
Hmm. Michael, is there any difference in the cabin space given the plug-in hybrid?
The tiniest little bit. So some underfloor storage is lost in the plug-in hybrid. I'm just bringing up my table here. So 12 litres less with 7 seats in use. And also 12 litres less with 5 seats in use. Come on, not a lot.
Not really noticeable.
In the scheme of things. You're certainly not a deal breaker is the packaging issue, that's for sure.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, so which one won?
Well, end of the day, if you're talking about what the winner is, I'm driving away in the diesel and I'm taking that $15,000 that I've saved and I'm buying a really awesome solar array and a household battery. And I'm probably making more of a dent in my carbon footprint by doing that. But if your question is there any point in the FEV? Does it bring anything to the table? Totally. Because it's completely silent around town. You don't have to idle in the school zone pumping out diesel fumes like you do in the diesel one. You can coast around in real refinement and solitude and smoothness, and that is not something that a diesel adventure-focused 4x4 can do. So in certain specific cases, provided you're the sort of person that can use it as intended, I could totally understand why you'd buy one. On the other hand, I wouldn't. I'd still stick with the diesel. Scott?
Mike, I know you're building to a conclusion there, but one more question for you. Who do you think actually is buying this? Because in my head, I've maybe got a picture of someone who walks into a showroom looking for an EV6 and then realizes that maybe they don't have the charging infrastructure for it, but they can do a smaller battery overnight. Is there anyone else who you can really see as walking into a dealership looking directly for this? Or do you think it's a brand builder for Kia that might sell in quite small numbers?
I think it's definitely more the latter. We know that company is doubling down on its electric car rollout. Toyota has made hybrids cool. There is a mild hybrid version of the Sorento coming, by the way, to capitalize on that. But in the meantime, the FEV is what it can offer. I suspect what it's all about is introducing the technology to Australian customers via one of its best known and most highly regarded cars. I can't see a hell of a lot of people hearing about the extra impost and signing on the dotted line. But I think what it will do is it'll get people at least thinking about this technology and pondering it in a way that they perhaps wouldn't have before. So would I expect to see many of these cars on the road? No, I probably wouldn't. Not yet. But I think they certainly play a role in a more big picture sense.
Mm. Perfectly said. The comparison is at the site now. Mike Costello, thank you very much.
Always great to join you guys.
All right. That's an end for this week's podcast. Some exciting cars we've got coming up next week, Scully.
We have got a fair few interesting utes, actually. We've got the LDV T60 facelift that will be with us all week. That's got more power and a new look and is going after the GWM Cannon, which is convenient because we have one of those in as well. Mm. And I don't know if this is just really good planning from James Wong or a bit of luck, but the SsangYong Musso XLV is also going to be in the garage. So at the moment, our plan is to get those three cars side by side out at the Werribee four-wheel drive center and do a little bit of off-roading, a little bit of uting in them, which should be good. We've also got a BMW X5 xDrive 40i, a Chevrolet Silverado Trail Boss. How American does that sound? Trail Boss. An Isuzu MUX LSU and a Honda Civic Hatch VTIL. And then up in Sydney, we've got a Suzuki Swift. And up in Queensland, there's some Ford stuff and some Ram 1500 models going through the garage as well. So a very ute-focused week, it looks like.
Is Croft driving the Swift?
TBC is driving the Swift, but I would wager it'll end up being Crawford, who actually he came on the podcast last year and talked about the Ignis, didn't he?
I was just going to say that he had so many good things to say about that thing. And you know what? The other day when I was driving to work, I am not kidding you, I saw three Ignises in about 30 seconds. They're not exactly a common car these days. I couldn't believe it.
Sounds like a glitch in the Matrix.
I think so. Thank you, Scott Colley and Jack Quick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thank you. Nice. All right.
I was wondering whether to plug my cheapest car article just then. I was like, oh, do I do it? Do I, like, because the
we'll
Ignis
the
is, I think I wanted to say the 8th cheapest car you can get in Australia at the moment.
Really?
So, yeah.
Ah.
That's probably a good little feature to talk about, just even as I'm working on it. Stay tuned.
It should be live this weekend. So by the time that the podcast comes out, it should – sorry, I should have just went for it, but, yeah.
No, that's all right. I'll still plan what we're going to do.
Oh, sick. Yeah, that sounds good.
Yep. What's the top one?
I have to read the story to find out.
I was going to spoil it. It's currently the Mirage, but TBC. If I did the story next month, it'd be interesting to see if the Mirage is still on sale, just due to the side impact regulations and stuff.